What's up, Oos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenbring. And we have a special guest today, the entertainment strategy guy, Alyssa ESG. I'm just going to go ESG. It's too many syllables otherwise. How are you today?
I am great and so glad to have a friend of the pod on the show.
I'll say I'm happy to be talking business strategy with friends.
Hey, there we go. Peter is out today. He should be back for the second half of this episode. We'll see. We'll see how this is all going to work out. I'm not sure. We got a lot of technical things we got to work on here to make sure this episode works. We'll see. All right. As I said, we're joined by our very special guest today for Cons and Nons, the Cons and Nons segment, the entertainment strategy guy. He's here to discuss the pros and cons of the potential acquisition of Warner Brothers by Netflix, or maybe by Paramount, or maybe by no one, who can say. You can find his stuff at The Ankler, of course, or his very own best-selling Substack, entertainment.substack.com. I feel like getting entertainment.substack.com is a big like URL bonus right there. You know, that's a good one.
Yeah, it definitely helped when it was still available, because I was like, well, that's better than entertainment strategy guy, because then it's like longer. So it's like, just grab that one.
It's just entertainment. All of the entertainment, yeah,
all of
right
it.
There.
All right.
He's got lots of charts. He's got lots of analysis, other cool things to show people about the business of Hollywood. And one thing, like the reason the most, well, maybe not the most useful, but the thing I find most useful is, for a long time, people said there's no ratings on streaming. There's no ratings. We can't. We don't know what people are watching. And if you read the entertainment strategy guy, you will know what people are watching and how well shows are doing and how well various streaming services are doing. I think it's a really important resource. If you are talking about or thinking about or writing about this industry, you better sign up for entertainment strategy guy. Before we get to the data, I want to do a quick Substack chat here for a second, because the first post that you wrote on this topic was titled "Why I Love," all caps, "Love Netflix Buying Warner Brothers." And then the second was titled "Why I Hate," again, all caps, anyone buying Warner Brothers. And in your first post, you made it pretty clear that you have your priors. Consolidation is bad. You've been writing about this for a long time. You know, Apple Studios should be split off of Apple. You know, there needs to be more and better kind of separation of these things. But I got the sense reading the top half of your second post that your industry readers were pretty upset by that first piece, because everybody in Hollywood is kind of freaking out right now. What was the mood in your inbox like after that went up?
It was actually like, I have this duality opinion of it, that as soon as I sat down to write about it, because I haven't liked the idea of more consolidation, because I tend to be very pro competition. My angle is more competition will especially tend to benefit talent in this town and below the line workers, because when you have more people competing for services, those wages tend to go up. And my rule of thumb is, like, if you imagine someone like, say, Taylor Swift, and you buy a ticket to go see her concert, if you ask most customers, like, hey, if you spend $100, how much do you want to go to Taylor? I think they would say all of it, 90% of it. I don't think anyone would be like, well, I think Ticketmaster deserves like 35% of this ticket. Like, that's never been said by anyone anywhere who exists, right? Mm-hmm. And the way you get talent, so it's like, same, think of your favorite filmmakers like Greta Gerwig or Christopher Nolan, or the actors in those movies. People would be like, I'm there to see them. They're the one creating this value. So how do you reward them? Competition. So by having the most buyers and the most sellers. And so it's actually a really capitalist focused view I have of this. So that's like my core prior. But that said, my name is Entertainment Strategy Guy. And while I usually wait when breaking news happens, this deal is so monumental, Netflix potentially buying Warner Brothers or Paramount swooping in, that I was like, well, I have to write about this right away. And I have to write about the strategy behind it, because that's what I do. I do business strategy. And looking at it on first blush, there's parts of their strategy that I love, 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 and understand that. And a lot of people agreed with me that they're like, yeah, that is a good description for why Netflix wants it. Except there were a lot of people, because this move, this deal has kind of awakened an antitrust fury in the community, that if they didn't read the article, gave me some feedback that they thought it was terrible. And I was like, well, just wait till Monday. And then the article went out Tuesday. But I was like, wait till Tuesday. You're going to see my actual take on this. So the issue, the whole deal is extremely like buzzy, but also I think it's going to be extremely divisive in this town going forward.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to the big point of part one there, which was, all right, so why does this deal make sense for Netflix? What is Netflix get out of this that they lack or that they are kind of improving upon?
So I laid out four key benefits, and I would add a fifth. It's kind of like a sub point of the first one I thought about later. But the first is just IP, IP, IP. Netflix for years, and I've heard through the grapevine, they have said, hey, entertainment strategy guy, when he does ratings, doesn't account for the fact that we don't have any IP. We have to essentially build it all ourselves. So we have to launch originals like Carry On, you know, originals like K-pop Demon Hunters, right? And that raises the bar, the difficulty level for what they have to do. And it's actually a fair point. Now, that said, you've noticed in recent years with things like the Knives Out films or Happy Gilmore 2, they've actually leaned more and more into IP. They did a lot of spinoffs of The Witcher is another example. But they don't have access to those treasure troves of characters, franchises, brands that have decades of history, which is what Warner Brothers has. So they get that IP right off the bat. The second piece related to that is also just the content library. You're talking about Warner Brothers Television that owns or co-owns thousands of episodes of television. And you have a movie studio that has decades, again, of film in their library that they can benefit from, both for new movies and old. So the IP and the content library are easily the biggest factor for why I think Netflix is buying Warner Brothers overall, and also ignoring the linear channels. Now, related to that, and I've heard this was the piece that I think most people agreed with in my analysis, was that there's also a big defensive play. So, you know, right now, Netflix's position in the paid subscription streaming realm is still far and away bigger than everyone else. They're not bigger than everyone else put together, but they are bigger than anyone else, which means they can monetize their content better. They have the lowest churn. They're still leading in that. The question is, if either Paramount or Comcast had won the deal and they could combine HBO with their existing streamer, that potentially becomes the third or second or fourth biggest streamer easily. And if it becomes the second or third streamer, and now Disney moves to like third place and Prime Video moves to like fourth place, now Netflix is that much more competition for eyeballs. And so the defensive move was a good push to stop that as well. The other piece is HBO is just really valuable as a brand. There's definitely, as I thought about this more, the integration of HBO is something that they're going to have to figure out. And how are they going to like incorporate them into the business? Do they smash everything on the Netflix? Do they keep two separate services? I don't know. But HBO is a legitimate, powerful brand in streaming, and having that is useful even for Netflix. And then the last piece is, which could be good news. I know I've listened, and the big worry is what happens to theaters. But buying Warner Brothers could allow them to do kind of what Amazon did with when they bought MGM Studios, is say, oh, hey, some films are going to theaters now. We never changed our policy. Warner Brothers films are doing that, but now they get to go to theaters. Or they could license some of their Netflix shows out to other brands because they now have a content licensing team with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers also has a lot more experience with consumer products than Netflix does internally, just because they've done it for years. So there's a lot of potential benefits from a business standpoint that they didn't used to have.
Alyssa, Wade, what questions do you have for...
Yeah, I wanted to know, so I mean, obviously we should all stipulate that there is just an enormous amount of doubt here about what the ultimate outcome is going to be. Like, Paramount has launched a hostile bid for all of Warner's assets, including CNN. There are questions about whether Netflix would get regulatory approval. All of this is likely to take a long time. But if the Netflix deal closes, what do you think the impact will be on consumers? Because one thing you mentioned in your post about why why you're sort of more anxious about this is the price of Warner Brothers and the amount of debt that Netflix would end up with at the end of this. So what does that mean for content in terms of what they can spend money on, how much stuff they can produce? What does this look like on the consumer end?
So the biggest impact on consumers will be, I think, break down into three pieces. The first is whatever happens to HBO. Because if you're someone, and they even have put this out as a benefit for the deals, that there are a lot of HBO-only consumers or subscribers. So there is the big question, what happens to HBO? My looking at the deal, it probably won't close for well into next year. If it closes, even then there could be a closing time after that. HBO, I realized later, is entangled with a lot of other sub-licensing deals. For example, Amazon Channel sells HBO subscriptions, right? Cable providers still sell HBO subscriptions, like AT&T mm-hmm. gives free subscriptions with their cellular service. So those are a lot of deals that if the deal closes, will have to get unraveled over time. But eventually, Netflix is going to have to decide, do they sell HBO as an add-on to their service? Do they bundle it with Netflix or some other third option that I can't quite figure out? My gut would be it's going to eventually join Netflix because running one streamer is easier, but then you're risking losing all those other subscribers in the meantime. So the biggest impact will be consumers, subscribers to HBO because they have to figure out what happens. Now, to your point about why I post it, which really comes down to the quality of the product and how much customers pay for it. Given the debt load, they will try and do a lot of efficiencies to decrease the number of their headcount, right? Redundant people, especially in things like marketing and legal teams, they just won't need as many, right? That's all true. But you're not going to get all the cost savings they want unless they also reduce the amount of shows they make, because now the shows are competing for each other. Now, internally, they'll pitch it as, hey, if we take the best HBO shows and the best Netflix shows, we'll have an even better, better show catalog. That's not really how it works, but I've seen people pitch that that idea. I just have to believe content production, which is already declining, the number of shows being made by Netflix in particular, will continue to decline. And essentially, they'll use Netflix shows to hide some of that decline. As for prices, again, like Netflix, we're talking about a company that at its peak, I think, had $15 billion in debt. And I've seen estimates out there that this will be at least $50 billion in debt. And that's if the price doesn't increase. And so, yes, they'll get more cash flow from the Warner Brothers properties and from the Warner Brothers, from HBO subscribers. But if they increase prices for both services, that's a lot easier way to pay for the debt. And I just right. have to think we're going to see that happen. And so consumers are going to see that hit their pocketbooks eventually.
Well,
can I ask just one quick follow-up study question? Yeah. The older Netflix debt was also cheaper to take on. It was at lower interest rates. Do you worry about an impact on the HBO brand if they start looking for efficiencies in terms of show production? Because, one of the real hallmarks of HBO really since Game of Thrones has been the ability to put on, blockbuster style spectacle on the small screen. And those shows are very expensive. And so, do you worry about a change to the kind of programming that HBO is able to produce?
That doesn't worry me as much, I have to be honest. Okay. Only because, I do think Casey Bloys is a key man over there. So I would make sure, I would do whatever it takes to keep him coming because he clearly understands the HBO brand. And I actually say this in that I'm debating updating my list of the hit makers in television. And to be clear, my rule of thumb for people who don't read me is that 95% of executives and showrunners are just average, which doesn't mean they're bad. It just means they're average. They may make one hit, they make two okay shows, and the rest are bombs. That's what Hollywood does. That's the average. But some are legitimate hit makers, and their hit rate is much more like two big hits and then four good shows and then four misses. looking at HBO's track record, that's actually been Casey Bloys' track record going back. Not every show hits it out of the park. But when you look at what HBO has pulled off, you know, just when Game of Thrones was ending, it's like, can they do it again? Here comes The Last of Us. That's a co-pro with Sony, but they still did it. The Pit managed to be both a commercial success and it's now a critical success. So I would keep Casey Bloys in place. And I have to think Netflix would understand the value that HBO offers and that track record. So I, given that they survived mergers with AT&T and Discovery, I have to think Netflix will allow them to survive. But if they didn't, that would be the biggest mistake they could make trying to close this deal.
The counter argument on price would be, right, so there are people right now who already pay for Netflix and already pay for HBO. If we bring HBO on and we increase the cost of Netflix by $5, that is that's probably a net savings for the people who subscribe to both anyway. Or they make the argument that, like, well, we're going to bring it in and it's going to be an add-on service. You have to pay an extra $10 a month, and that's still cheaper than you know what folks were paying. So I mean, the price thing is interesting because this is getting back to our discussion about antitrust, right? The argument, the prevailing legal theory on antitrust at this moment, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is lower prices for consumers means okay.
Yes.
Basically, right? Like that is and if Netflix is able to come in and say, well, look, we're saving people $10 a month by doing this, then that could in and of itself be ball game, right?
It could. Matthew Stoller, who writes about antitrust also on Substack in a terrific newsletter, he emphasizes that for this deal, the Clayton Act would hold. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so if I get any of this wrong, I apologize. Where simply lowering competition is the standard. But yeah, when it comes to the established monopolization framework, the consumer welfare standard that was pioneered by Robert Bork in the 80s is definitely the standard, and that focuses on price and the quality of the product. And so absolutely, in that scenario you pitch, they could combine both services and it's cheaper and it's a win for everyone. My worry whenever we see these deals is that 5 years down the line, it's now not cheaper. You know, Netflix is a service that has increased prices like clockwork every year. It'll be interesting to see if they do the same next year, you know, with the scrutiny of this deal, because they might avoid it simply to look more consumer friendly to regulators. But we're going to have to see.
Yeah. Let's jump real quick over to the Paramount side of things, because I do think that I think that this is, you can't understand the Netflix side without looking at the Paramount side as well. And let's set aside the Trump of it all. Let's set aside the regulatory hullabaloo, which, you know, is not a good thing to set aside. But let's just for the purposes of this discussion right now, let's set that aside. Looking at this from Paramount's perspective, if you look at, all right, so I just look at the numbers that Nielsen puts out for their gauge, right? Yeah. And I realize that this does not capture laptop usage. It doesn't capture phone usage, right? When Nielsen puts out numbers,
it's just living room televisions.
Their gauge, it's just what people are watching on television. But if you look at the structures of these deals, Netflix is only picking up the HBO Max portion of Warner Brothers Discovery.
Yep.
Whereas Paramount is picking up HBO Max plus the cable networks, which would be all of Warner Brothers Discovery. And there are two different, they put out two different charts that kind of break this down. But like the long and the short of it is, Netflix would be picking up a much smaller portion of the overall share of what is being watched.
Yes.
At least on television, than Paramount would be. Like, arguably, looking at it through the lens of consolidation of who controls how much of what people watch, this is a deal that Paramount actually consolidates much more of the streaming viewing market with.
Yeah, it goes from, if you're worried about Netflix, you're worried about combining two streamers, and you're worried about combining two movie studios and two TV production houses, right? And I think that's anti-competitive. When you go to Paramount, you're adding those three, plus you're adding cable networks, potentially broadcast channel, potentially sports rights, potentially all these other things. The biggest one would actually be adding the Discovery channels to the Paramount channels. Gives them a much stronger position as they negotiate with cable providers about how to cut up that. And as we just saw with YouTube TV and Disney, you know, those carriage battles are still going on. This gives them a lot more power to negotiate those deals. And in that case, when I'm using the term power, getting market power gives you the ability to force either suppliers or buyers to take worse deals. And that's what makes it so anti-competitive. So absolutely, this combines even more if it went through with Paramount.
So, and sort of as a corollary to that, I mean, I think we have a sense that the political valence of CNN would change if Paramount bought the whole enchilada. I mean, David Ellison seems to have sort of explicitly promised that. What do you think happens to CNN if Netflix wins out? Because part of this is contingent on those other assets being spun off. Who's the likely buyer? Do you think Paramount still tries to buy those assets?
No, I think if Netflix wins the deal and they spin off into the SpinCo company, I think the likeliest outcome is that they then try and merge with another group of cable channels, like the Versant cable channels, to essentially have all that power there. CNN's fate would be determined. Even if a Paramount deal went through, I could see CNN getting spun off by itself simply to like avoid some conflicts of interest and then try and make it so small that it can't really survive out there on the open market by itself. Every time Warner Brothers has been bought in the past, there's also been this like movement and divestment or acquisition of assets. I think you'd see something similar. Like I still bring up that AT&T sold Crunchyroll to Sony. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, you know who wishes they had Crunchyroll right now? Like Warner Brothers Discovery. Yeah. So I would imagine that they'll divest some assets that'll also help them add some cash to their balance sheet. But the CNN question, exactly what happens, is definitely up in the air.
Yeah. And I mean, I think just what that means for the news ecosystem, as well as for the entertainment ecosystem writ large, is a really interesting one.
I actually think there would have been a version where CNN would have been very interesting inside of Netflix as well. I bet
they don't have a news product.
They don't have any news product. They've actually, what I think is a very smart strategy. I'm going to write about this in my end of the year news column. They have been moving more towards creators, but doing some smart plays with podcasts that do video, like with Bill Simmons' The Ringer podcast. I think it's actually really smart for Netflix. They don't have to build a newsroom. They can use other people who've built newsrooms, just give them a small paycheck and essentially get news product, which I think is really smart. But I think overall, the reason they don't want CNN is Netflix doesn't want the hassle of the news wars. They see what happens with Disney, Comcast, NBC Universal, Paramount, Skydance. The news business gets them in trouble. I mean, 60 Minutes got Paramount, Skydance in trouble just this week, right? So it keeps happening. And I think Netflix wants to try and avoid that as much as possible.
I would if I were them as well.
I mean, and then there's the sports question here, which, you know, Netflix is, it's been kind of fascinating watching them dip their toes into sports and sports like events like the Jake Paul boxing, you know, Mike Tyson thing and everything else. Do we think this will have, let's say the deal goes through for Netflix. Do we think that they become real players in the NBA or NFL space? Or is that still something that, you know, they're like, don't know if we want a weekly or daily commitment there in terms of, you know, the NBA?
I don't think they will, actually. And again, whenever you're predicting, it's like half the time, it's like you make this prediction, like, I don't think they will. And then they do. And you're like, well, drat. I think actually Netflix right now has the most cost-focused strategy on sports that is also kind of brilliant. Sorry, I'm like complimenting Netflix a ton, which also the other feedback I got is people are like, oh, this guy's a huge Netflix bull. He loves Netflix. And I was like, you have not been reading me for a little while. Like, tell me you don't read my work without... Yeah. Yeah. Tell me you don't read my work without telling me. But what they've realized is that if you have to pay for an entire season of games for like the NFL or the NBA, it's extremely expensive. But because of their platform, if they only buy one or two, they can get the benefit of access to those customers without having to pay that crazy high amount, and it keeps their cash flow in line. Basically, if they had done one of the NBA style deals that either Disney or NBC or Prime Video did, their cash flow like gets cut in half. They'd almost have trouble making a deal like this, pulling it off. And so that's why I think they really like the idea of having one event from each sport, but not having to do all the sports. If they, the other piece of evidence for this is if they really wanted to get into a sport, they probably would have started snatching up F1 rights, but they let those go to Apple. And now they really like something they can air globally. And so this was just US rights for F1. And a lot, there are a lot of big players for the rest of the F1 rights globally. But if they really wanted to, F1 probably would have been the sport that made the most sense to go all in, because soccer is a little diffuse. I don't think they would earn those rights. And so avoiding that, I think, is a sign they really like the one-off special strategy. And I don't think this acquisition changes that, especially because they're not buying the linear channels as well.
Well, and that also sort of makes sense with HBO's history in boxing, right? I mean, the sort of consistent, like, you know, set time slot viewing that is required for, you know, all of the other sports, but particularly baseball, is just so in tension with the way Netflix operates.
Absolutely.
But if you have these sort of one-off events, that makes much more sense sort of as an exception rather than the rule.
Exit question here, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, but what is the best outcome here for consumers? What is, I'm me, Joe streaming pants in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I'm just sitting here watching my TV. I got my apps up, and I'm like, this, what's the best for me?
So Joe streaming pants, I have an entertainment strategy guy definitions doc that I made. So if you ever hear terms on the internet, you don't know what they mean, go to my website. I have a whole list. Joe streaming pants, I think it's going to have to like make an appearance. I'm going to have to start using that.
Good.
And Sheboygan too.
Specifically.
In the holidays. Yeah. Yes. Specifically from Sheboygan. The best outcome, there is a tension in that I've heard people put out there that, you know, for customers, there really was sort of this benefit to the cable channel bundle of old, and that all the content was there. You might not have had HBO and Showtime because those were the two things you had to pay extra for. And I guess Cinemax and Stars eventually, right? But you had it all there. And then once you had the DVD player or the DVR, you could also time delay everything, right? So you had this list of shows you could watch. And it's probably like the best customer experience. And I hate to report that. I don't think we're ever going to get back there. Because Amazon, Google, Roku would all like to, Apple would all like to offer that service. But I don't think any of them is just going to give up. So we're never going to get back there. So for the lack of that, the best outcome for consumers, and I believe this to my bones, and I could wax on like theoretically about why I believe this, is more competition. Because when you have more competition, it encourages more people to do innovative things. It encourages people to pay talent more. It makes more content overall, and that tends to just be better for consumers overall. It also adds a price check to streaming prices, because when you have less competition, that's why you see prices go up for consumers. So the more viable streamers you have, the more price pressure there is on everyone to keep prices low. So in that case, not having a deal at all would be the best outcome, though I would put that probability extremely low at this point, because I think one of Netflix or Paramount is going to at some point win this deal, and then we'll go to the courts. And I would tend to bet that the deal gets approved even through the courts. But in some crazy alternate scenario where both parties agree, like, no, let's keep these things separate, that would be the biggest win for consumers. And I would actually go further. But again, that's more of my political economy thinking, not the entertainment strategy thinking.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you for joining us on this segment of Cons and Nons. We're gonna kick you out because we're gonna review movies. I know you don't like to get into that sort of thing.
So I've never been trained in the dark arts of film criticism. I know you guys go to the magic school where they teach.
We go to wizard
criticism.
School.
Yeah, 100%. To learn how to do it, and I've never been accepted. So
yeah,
I just know movie good. Good, movie bad. So.
But no, thanks for breaking this down for us and our listeners. This has been great.
Thank you for having me. And like as you said at the top, go to my Substack if you want all the latest news on streaming ratings and streaming news, and you know, support Across the Movie Aisle by buying a paid subscription, which I have. So.
See, that's a very nice thing for you to say. So you should do all of those things. Go to
I still need to buy a t-shirt, though. I still need to get a t-shirt. So.
They're the hot Christmas item, is my understanding.
They're very comfy and stylish. I can, as someone who wears mine regularly, I'm a big fan. I'm going for the sweatshirt next.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Many thanks to the entertainment strategy guy for stopping by. We hope he'll enjoy our bonus episode on Thursday about ensemble movies. We're tying that to, of course, the ridiculous ensemble assembled for Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. Speaking of which, on to our main event. Full disclosure, I am not enormously fond of the Knives Out movies. The first is fun. It's kind of fun. It has this very tight script that combines elements of both the whodunit and Hal Ketchum genres of mystery storytelling. Think Agatha Christie by way of Columbo. But it is also, let's be honest, it's a kind of a smarmy, smug movie. That kind of represents very strongly a certain type of resistance lib progressivism. It's the sort of movie where no one is a real person. Everyone, hero and villain alike, is a stand-in for some element of the author's worldview. The pure immigrant, the wicked white privilege. You know, it's just the storytelling that ditches subtext. It like actually mocks the idea of subtext. It's like subtext. What? Why would we bother with that? Glass Onion was the first of the sequels made for Netflix as part of the $469 million deal that Rian Johnson made with the streaming giant. And it was also incredibly smarmy. It was actually somehow even smarmier. And it did not have the benefit of the clockwork tight script. The whole thing culminates with Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc simply screaming that the film's Elon Musk stand-in is stupid, which is undoubtedly emotionally satisfying. I don't like the guy either, but it's completely uninteresting as a matter of storytelling. All of which to say is I was not quite dreading Wake Up Dead Man, which brings Benoit Blanc to an upstate Catholic parish where a longtime priest, Monsignor Wicks, who's played by Josh Brolin, has been murdered. But I wasn't really looking forward to it either. I was a little bit wary. The prime suspects in this new case that Benoit Blanc is out to solve is the newly arrived priest Judd Duplantisi. Am I pronouncing that right? Duplantisi? I don't know.
Good enough.
Played by Josh
Father
O'Connor.
Judd.
Father Judd. Father Judd. Everybody is. It's very nice. Everybody just kind of goes by their. It's very first namey. Sort of movie. He's played by Josh O'Connor. He's been sent to Our Lady of Perpetual Fortitude after assaulting a deacon in his home parish. Is he to blame for the death of the fire and brimstone preacher keeping watch over his dwindling flock? Or is it the devout Martha, played by Glenn Close? Or the drunk doctor, Nathaniel Sharp, played by Jeremy Renner? Or the lawyer trapped in this small town, Vera, played by Kerry Washington? Or the hacky sci-fi author, Lee, played by Andrew Scott? Or the nerve-damaged cellist, Simone, played by Kaylee Spaney? Or the would-be MAGA Great Black Hope, Cy Draven, played by Daryl McCormick? I'm not going to discuss the mechanics of the mystery at the heart of this movie, the who, the what, the where, the why, as we might break it down in Clue, a game that Benoit Blanc very much dislikes. Maybe we'll discuss that more in a minute. And this is going to be a spoiler heavy episode. I think so. If you want to watch this and you don't want to have the movie ruined, you should just turn it off now and go watch the movie and then come back and listen to this, or watch this on the Substack. What I'd like to hit on here is the difference in tone between this and the first two films in the series. Yes, again, Rian Johnson can't really help himself. The worst characters in this film code as right-wing doofuses. The more progressively coded are kinder and more decent. He has a real identity politics thing going on where a certain type of person can't really be the hero or the villain. It's very annoying. Cy Draven in particular takes it on the chin as the MAGA type pole. He is there's a very funny moment in which he rattles off a list of grievances he was simply unable to capitalize on with his potential voters. It goes on, and it's one of these things. It's like it's a Family Guy joke that like keeps going so long that it's not funny, and then it's funny again somehow. It's pretty good. But it's the first of these movies to treat the killer, the actual killer, with something akin to understanding. And it's the first to offer the chance of forgiveness, or absolution is a word we might use for the murder. And I use that word absolution intentionally, as this is a very Catholic movie, all the more so since Johnson and his mouthpiece Blanc are very much atheists. You need Blanc's aggressively vocal atheism in this movie in order for the conclusion, in which he, the detective, offers the guilty a chance to confess their sins and, by the guilty's own logic, save their soul, to pack the appropriate emotional punch. Setting all that aside, this is the best looking of these movies, and it maybe is Johnson's best looking movie since, I don't know, Brick, at least since Looper, certainly. There's just lots of fun stuff with lights and camera angles. And there, he does, again, there's a shot used a couple of times in this movie that calls to mind something that we saw once or twice in Brick, where there's like a fist coming toward a face, and it's like a cut from the fist to the face, and you get the aftermath of it there on the screen. It's again, it's just like kind of interestingly shot. The color is very interesting. There's this great shot in a flashback sequence where we see a harried woman kind of shot with a giant blood red moon behind her backlit. It's this very gothic shot. The scene is soaked in this giallo-esque, you know, kind of red blood color. I dug it. It's a big step up from Glass Onion, which I rewatched recently and was struck again by just how kind of phony everything looked. There's so much CGI additions to the buildings in that movie that it has always struck me as weirdly fake. I've never really loved it. It's just a big step up, I thought. Peter, what did you make of Wake Up Dead Man?
I quite like this movie. I think it's the best of the series so far. I'm not sure I loved it, but it's very good. As you said, it looks really nice, I would say. The moon there is not just a step up from Glass Onion. This has been a big year for big moons in movies.
Big moons.
Right?
Big
moon we all remember the absolutely ridiculous moon in Working Man, right?
Which Working is, Man.
Like, the only thing I remember from that movie, to be honest. But I remember that moon, and that was the worst moon. This is the best moon. But there's so many just really nice visual touches, and they all have a little bit of a kind of exaggerated, almost kind of, I want to say it's like nearing cartoon level of kind of like, it's not subtext. Like, the images are quite clear in what they're trying to say, even when it's coded through image rather than explicitly, you know, said by a character in the script. And yet the images are so precise and so carefully calibrated and just so pleasant to look at. I complain often on this podcast about movies that are garbage to look at and make me mad when I have to watch them, right? Wicked, the second one, right? Like, just made me mad having to also have my eyes on this, right? First one as well, right? But that more recently, the second one. And it's just nice to look at a movie that someone has considered how it looks all throughout. But the other thing is, it's not just this. You talked about this as being a Catholic movie, as being maybe a little less smug. The thing that stood out to me and what makes this the best of the Knives Out films is not just that it's a little less smug. It's a movie that is reckoning, in some sense, with the smugness of the previous two films, and doing so in a way that reads as, I don't know, sometimes it's still a little smug because that's Johnson, right? That's how he is. And he can't help himself, like you said. At the same time, he's trying. He's actually trying. He's trying to, like, come up with something that is like, yeah, I'm like that. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm not like that. I'm not going to pretend I'm not the guy who made the first two Knives Out films. But maybe I need to, in a dramatic way, in the form of drama, try to argue with myself and try to see if there's some other side here. And he makes a pretty good attempt. And so many of the kind of, I now have to like go down a rabbit hole just because of like where Substack has been for the past week. But like, there's been this whole big argument about like, maybe art shouldn't be political, or maybe it should be, or whatever. And like, I just, to be for everyone's purposes, it's totally fine for art to be political. It shouldn't be annoying and self-satisfied. And that was what was frustrating about the first couple of Knives Out films, was that they were annoying and self-satisfied. It's not just that they were political. And this is a movie that that tries, I think, often successfully to attack its own smugness and to interrogate it. There is this totally incredible scene that people have talked about already in the middle of the movie, where the where Josh O'Connor's priest character is trying to get a clue out of a woman who's working a desk at a construction company. And he's just trying to get some information from her. And he's like, really, it's like important to get this particular piece of information. It's to reveal who the killer is. And she's like, yeah, you got to go through this process. It's like a little bit of a detective thing, right? And then she just sort of stops and is like, and Father, I also have to tell you. And the scene just goes into a place that actually has nothing to do with the very specific plot mechanisms of the murder mystery. Instead, it's about the power of faith and what he's there to do as a priest. And he's there to not be smug with her and to not advance the plot. And it has to end like her life and her pain in that moment. The movie actually allows that to take center stage and to say, this is more important actually to the work of being a priest than all the razzle dazzle of the mystery solving. And the movie does stuff that's the most sort of prominent moment, but the movie does stuff like that all the time. And it seems to be having this argument with itself about whether it wants to be just that dazzling murder mystery with the big speech at the end, you know, that you know is coming, which everything is revealed and all is the puzzle is solved, or whether this wants to be a movie about faith, about how faith in religion, in institutions and political figures can go wrong, but also about how faith can be real and meaningful and important in people's lives. And it reminded me a lot, actually, of this line that got repeated in all of the Tom Stoppard obituaries, where Stoppard was asked early in his career about whether or not he was political as a playwright. And he was like, well, not really. You know, I just sort of like to play around with words. I like drama because it's the place where I can contradict myself, right? Because he can put opposing ideas in the characters' voices. And you saw that all throughout. I mean, he developed a sort of somewhat clearer political through line later in life, but you saw this all throughout his career. Was part of what made him wonderful was he allowed his characters to embody completely different worldviews and to then argue with themselves without the writer stepping in to take a side. And you see that all throughout this movie in a way that I think is really pretty admirable, and actually I would say made me think much, much better of Johnson after being impressed with him but kind of annoyed with him for the past several years.
Yeah, I think that the scene with the telephone call has a lot of people have highlighted that. And it's funny because I had kind of forgotten about it. I wouldn't say I had forgotten about it, but I had not really thought of it as that important, despite it being a very good scene, because it is such a natural scene is the thing. It like this is the way that these characters would behave. And I don't mean to again, I really like Rian Johnson's Brick. I like Looper a lot as well, even though it's kind of pastiche. But he has never been a naturalistic director. I would never describe him as somebody who lets the characters just do things that real people would do. They are always in service of usually the plot, but they behave in ways that very often reflect him and his sensibilities. And it's such a natural and smooth scene because it feels real. And when I started thinking about it more, I was like, oh wow, that is kind of a triumph for him. That is like, that's showing some growth, I think.
But you see that throughout the movie. I mean, it's not in every single scene, but when Benoit Blanc shows up in the church for the first time, he's, you know, this swaggering atheist detective who just thinks that absolutely everything in the world could be resolved based on physical evidence. And right, it's just materialistic, secular, whatever, right? And even in his swagger, he is momentarily not quite overcome, but kind of taken with, he talks about like the architecture and the meaning of the place. And he's like, you can see even Blanc is like, there's something else here. It's not for me. It's not my thing. But there is something else that's real to a lot of people. And I have to respect that. And the movie takes that viewpoint all throughout. Like I said, in a way that I just think is quite admirable.
Yeah, he grows up from Reddit atheist into less annoying regular atheist, which is nice. Alyssa, what did you make of Wake Up Dead Man?
Quite liked this. And I think part of what is very interesting about it is that it is playing with mystery in both senses of the word, right? I mean, because at the heart of Christian faith, in particular Catholic faith, is this idea that there are holy mysteries, right? There are the kind of unholy mysteries that Benoit Blanc solves in the world. But there are, you know, faith involves an acceptance of mystery, right? I mean, what does it mean to be Mary and to be pregnant with the Son of God, right? And what does it mean to have the kind of, you know, faith and courage to accept that and accept your son's inevitable death? The resurrection is a mystery, right? There are just these, you know, mysteries and miracles are not precisely the same thing, but there is this, you know, you have the idea of mystery and, you know, in the sense of crime as something to be unraveled, and mystery in the sense of the sort of holy and the profound that is to be accepted as it is. And those worldviews are in tension in ways that the movie manages deftly without sort of, you know, hammering that tension too far. But part of what is moving about the end of the movie is Benoit Blanc setting aside his version of mystery for the kind of mystery that's embodied in forgiveness. Sort of absolution delivered through confession, right? I mean, that it's not the same sort of mystery as a man, you know, dying on the cross and rising to live again, but it is, you know, it is a transformative mystery in and of itself. And that's, you know, there's a real sort of beauty in the movie's logic that I found quite moving. But I also think this is a movie that really works because of Josh O'Connor's performance. Yeah. And, you know, he has become really quickly for me one of those actors where it's like, Josh O'Connor is in it, I'm going to go see it. There is something just so sort of warm and open-hearted in his performance here, right? I mean, he does not come across necessarily as like a, you know, like Father James Martin or one of the sort of, you know, liberal priests who have kind of become celebrities of the left. I mean, he comes as someone who found something really deep and meaningful in his Catholic faith and, you know, approaches it with real rigor and is not interested in using his faith to curry favor in some faction of the outside world, right? Like he embodies that sense of mystery that is, you know, that is belief, that is the ability to grant forgiveness. And it's really warm and lovely. And he's just, the movie absolutely would not work with a lesser actor in that role at all. But it is also just, it is a...
While we're talking really about Josh O'Connor, can I ask you a question real quick?
Of course.
Did you have some sense that maybe it was written for... the Vader son in Last Jedi.
Adam Driver?
Adam Driver, sorry. Just completely lost the name there. A day later, I just kept rewatching the movie in my head with Adam Driver instead of Josh O'Connor. And I was like, oh, it seems like maybe that was the intention, because one thing that Johnson said recently was that Josh O'Connor was actually Benoit Blanc's, Daniel Craig's idea.
Huh.
And that he had not heard of Josh O'Connor until Daniel Craig suggested him. So he was thinking of something else when he was writing it.
I mean, I suppose I could see that. You know, Driver, I think Adam Driver is, you know, clearly one of the great actors of, you know, that sort of generation of actors. You know, he's a little showy. He's a big presence. And O'Connor can be a big presence, right? I mean, his sort of like sexy dirtbag, you know, tennis pro in Challengers. It's like, that's a big performance. But he is generous. He's sort of willing to be small and unglamorous, or smaller, or I don't know. That maybe I'm not describing it accurately. He's just,
it changes the way his boxing reads, right? Versus someone like Adam Driver, who simply, as you say, is a physically, he's a large person, right?
Yeah.
Like he's a big
he's
guy.
Tall, yeah.
He's and he's, even though he's not buff like a Hemsworth, right? He's strong. And has that sort of military background, whereas Josh O'Connor reads as, yeah, a boxer, but he's sort of scrappy.
He's wirier.
Sort of messy.
It's definitely a different physical presence. But I think this is a very humane movie in some ways. Both of you have mentioned the fact that it's less smug. And I think specifically it's less smug in two ways. It is genuinely interested in the question of why all of these suspects would be drawn to someone like Monsignor Wicks. And there is a range of answers, right? I mean, you have, you have someone like the novelist who is, sort of seeking a commercial comeback and has, kind of found material. You have someone who sees the Monsignor as a potential political asset. That's Cy Draven. You have someone who, has kind of sacrificed her life to her sense of what's supposed to be good and kind of can't acknowledge that maybe she's done the wrong thing or that the supposed right thing that she's devoted her life to is actually quite corrupt. You've got that in Vera. You've got someone like Dr. Nat who has, been through a really wounding experience, right? Like his wife left him. And he is sort of trying to find a way to be whole again. You have someone who, has suffered real physical pain and is seeking a miracle in the church. That's Kayleigh Spaney's cellist character. There is not, as there is in Glass Onion, the sense that like, all these people are, sort of bonded together by their kind of mutual corruption and self-interest. Like there are a lot of reasons why someone would be drawn to a harsh, purifying vision of Christianity. But then you also have the movie's exploration of how you, someone who is in a position of power, like a priest, uses that power. And, you have this kind of funny but ugly set of scenes where you see Monsignor Wicks abuse Father Judd's patience with confession, right? By like sort of ginning up these elaborate confessional scenarios that, seem like they're not probably real. They're essentially a form of like sexual harassment through confession. And you see, those differing uses of power. And, you can, I wouldn't say the movie has a ton of sympathy for Monsignor Wicks, but you do get a backstory that suggests that, he came from a very sort of rigid, emotionally deprived, kind of morally ugly background. And there, I think the movie, like, he's eminently killable as a character, just as the deacon that Father John punches is like sort of described as eminently punchable. But there is just much more sympathy in this movie. And there are some characters who end up, getting what they maybe not richly deserve, but there are also some characters who really don't. And it is just a, it is a movie that kind of embodies Father Judd's perspective on the whole, which makes it unusual, not just among the Glass Onion movies, but I think kind of among movies, period, right? There's a difference between, kind of just siding with your characters reflexively and recognizing that, like, your characters are sinners, but sort of loving them anyway and having that love be kind of transformational. I found the whole thing just uplifting in a way that's sort of weird to say about a murder mystery movie. There's something kind without being squishy in it. And I really appreciated that.
It does sort of seem like Johnson wanted to make a Father Judd mystery and had $470 million from Netflix to make two Benoit Blanc mysteries. And so it was like, well, I'll make a Father Judd mystery and Benoit Blanc will show up in it. He's definitely riffing on the formula. I don't quite mean that, like, he just like retcon, you know, sort of squeezed in Blanc at the very end. But Blanc is second fiddle in the as detective here.
Well, he's barely in the movie for the first 45 minutes. Like he does not
show up till the act break.
He does not. He really doesn't. It's funny.
I do think part of the way that you keep these, you know, these murder mystery franchises interesting is, you know, to have the detective character ebb and flow, right? I mean, when we reviewed Death in Venice, you know, the Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of the Hercule Poirot mystery, you know, we all sort of remarked on the extent to which Branagh's Poirot was clearly sort of questioning his calling and was sort of burned out by the amount of death that he'd seen. There was a real sort of, you know, kind of shift in tone, a real sense that, you know, of serialization even among these movies, you know, that there's some sort of continuity and growth, even though the stories are episodic. And I would be sort of curious to see what the next Benoit Blanc mystery looks like, right? I mean, who does Benoit Blanc become over time? And it doesn't have to be sort of heavily character driven. But you do get the sense that the story is, there is sort of a, you know, a thread between the mysteries. That's maybe
there's also
going
just
somewhere.
This funny sense that Benoit Blanc is solving all these other mysteries off screen, right? There's that whole bit about the Kentucky Derby, right? That and how he read, and like Father Judd's just like, you were on The View.
Yep.
It's like, yep. I mean, like, well, I actually kind of cracked up.
Yeah, I mean, the Sherlock Holmes stories are like that too, right? I mean, there's, you know, Dr. Watson is always sort of beavering away, writing up these case accounts of cases that, like, we never actually see Holmes solve. I mean, this is all part of a very venerable tradition. And it's, you know, it's hard to invent that simultaneously serial and episodic storytelling for a character from scratch. And, you know, if this is any indication, Johnson seems to be getting somewhat better at it as he goes.
Did you guys find Father Wicks to be a sort of a stand-in for Trump? Because it seemed to me like part of what Johnson was trying to do here with this cast of like intense followers, all of whom, Alyssa, you were just right to like totally correct to sort of identify as, he sees them coming into this demagogue's orbit for different reasons, right? Some for political reasons, some because of their career, some because they're looking for a miracle to help them walk again, right? Or not feel pain. Some because they have family history, right? There's all of these different reasons that draw people into this circle. And he is this, you know, sort of quasi monster, but also someone with a difficult past, and in particular, a difficult rich father, right? Who is hard, you know, had founded the thing that he had inherited, right? I mean, it seems like, I don't want to say that it is just a one note and only a Trump, you know, allegory. At the same time, like, I think that's a pretty straightforward reading here. But I haven't seen people talk about this.
Possible. I mean, certainly like the videos that Psy is posting of him with the sort of like manipulated images really read as riffs on the like hyper buff action figure Trump that has kind of proliferated as a meme. And I think that reading is totally plausible, but it's also interesting that in that reading, some of the original demagogue's some of the demagogue's followers decide that they have had enough, right? Like there is a moral line that the character crosses at some point that not everyone finds intolerable, but some people do. That is interesting as commentary, not just on sort of Trump himself, but on people in his orbit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that read is definitely and very obviously there, but I also appreciated that it was not as simplistically one note as Glass Onion's Elon Musk Mank was. You know, I just think it's I think that is it's better in this. And to your point, Alyssa, one thing I found pretty interesting about this movie is that, look, again, the Knives Out movies have been very much movies of their time, right? The 2019 one is very much about it is very much in conversation with everything that's going on in 2019 in terms of the political landscape.
Immigrants are good. Yep.
Immigrants are good. And like Hamilton, we can make fun of the people who like Hamilton now, right? Like it's like a very specifically 2019 thing here where like
there's too much Hamilton. Now we can, you know, and but then 2022 is very much about COVID and again, Elon Musk and, you know, the whole kind of fraud of the tech super genius, et cetera. And this movie does an interesting thing because if we think about these movies as mirrors of their time or, you know, discussions of their time, movies about their time, then this is a movie that says you can still have absolution, people who follow this person. You have to realize that you need it. You have to ask for it. But it can be great. It is a movie that is intended to give people an off ramp, is how I would put
it.
Yeah, it's at least a movie about a moment in time where there is an off ramp for people to take if they want to take it. And again, I think that Wicks is very much a Trump figure, and is, you know, the Cy Draven character is very much a kind of MAGA influencer, would-be politician, et cetera, et cetera. But there, the deeper lesson, the deeper idea of this movie is you can stop this. You can. You just have to make that choice. Which is interesting.
No, I think that's right. And that there are real sort of permanent costs to not making that choice, right? I mean, you know, the sort of joke about Lee, like, getting his best-selling novel, but his best-selling, like, his fans are not the people that he wanted to win back. You know,
they and all someone look like John Goodman from The Big Lebowski, and then the line at the end.
It's so funny. And someone like Vera just sort of being like, I'm done. I'm leaving. Like, there's just, yeah. And not just that you can make a different choice, but like Trump will be gone at some point. Like, unless the tech moguls have figured out how to change the Constitution, make him live forever, like, there will be a period when Donald Trump is not the most salient fact in American politics. And, you know, I think that it has been very hard for people to exercise the political imagination to sketch out different scenarios for what that's going to be like. But that moment is coming. And it is going to be an enormous, enormous shift. And this, in a sense, this movie does feel a little bit more forward-looking than some of the other two.
So, all right. Can I just ask one question on that then? Which is, if that's...
I don't want to spend...
If that's the read here, isn't the movie in some sense forgiving people for the crime of murdering our Trump stand-in?
No. I mean, I think you're getting very literal about it. I think that's not specifically, certainly not. I don't know.
Me getting literal?
Yeah.
There's also, spoiler alert, only one murderer who needs to be forgiven, and then like a bunch of people who make different choices and have different paths out. So I think that's maybe, yeah, I'm unconvinced by that.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery? Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Thumbs up. Best Netflix movie I've seen this year and the best of this series.
Thumbs up. Is it the best Netflix? No, Train Dreams is better than this. But it's up there for as far as Netflix movies go. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends, strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's show, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday or Thursday. Thursday. No, not Friday. Thursday, hopefully.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.